Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, after a lifetime of working with the poorest children in America, Jonathan Kozol helps us understand their harsh realities and the factors that help the most disadvantaged kids to thrive. Then, on the Scholar Circle, what is driving the growing poverty levels in America and what should be done about it? 25 years ago, Jonathan Kozol documented the harsh realities of some of the poorest Americans in their struggles to survive. Now in his latest book, he revisits their lives. Some didn't survive, but others more than thrived, using their successes to contribute to other underprivileged kids. What were the factors that made the difference between the ones who survived and the ones who didn't? One of the keys, says Jonathan Kozol, is education. Jonathan Kozol joins us now. He's the author of numerous books, Death at an Early Age, Savage Inequalities, Amazing Grace, and the latest, Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America. Welcome, Jonathan Kozol.
Thank you.
For people who don't know your work, I'd like to start with how you began down this path interviewing these incredibly impoverished people and documenting their lives. How did you decide to do this, and how did you find them?
I've been teaching and working with inner-city kids since 1964, when I first heard the voice of Dr. Martin Luther King and then decided to go right into an inner-city classroom and teach kids in order to see if I could make a difference on my own. And that was in Boston, where I'd gone to college at Harvard, and I'd been away and returned. Actually, I was about to go back into academic life and become a professor, but Dr. King's voice really changed my life forever. Starting in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I began spending almost all my time in New York City in a section of the city called Mott Haven. Mott Haven was then and is today the poorest neighborhood in all of the South Bronx. South Bronx is still today the poorest congressional district in America. I mean, I'd never seen poverty like this before. Still very, very poor there, even to this day. The average household income for a family of just mother and three kids is, believe it or not, $17,000 for everything. But, of course, my interest was in children, and I walked into public schools there. Principals knew me from earlier books like Savage Inequalities. And so they let me go right into the schools and let me go into any classroom I wanted. I walked into kindergarten and I met some kids that to this day are my closest friends. Not all of them survived. There were three young men, little boys then, who never really recovered from the battering they underwent in that neighborhood, which was just like the worst place in the world you could ever bring up a child. It was not simply destitute, but the schools there were probably among the worst in the United States, still are. And three of the boys never recovered. All three took their lives, ultimately, one by a bullet to the brain, another intentionally by an overdose of heroin, and a third by doing something crazy. This was in New York. They ride on the tops of trains under the subway tunnels of New York. It's called surfing. And this boy had just been given a horrible time in the schools and never received the services he needed. His friends were lying down flat on the top of the train, but he, in a moment of bravado, as if to say, "This city can't beat me down," suddenly sat up, lifted his head up, and waved at his friends, and a steel beam from overhead struck his skull. He shuddered twice and he was dead. And there were several kids who never did recover from what they went through as children. On the other hand, and this is the main part of my new book, Fire in the Ashes, there were a lot of kids who did survive and didn't really survive, but in part because of their own guts, drive, and persistence, but more because of people who could intervene in their lives, grown-ups, who could help them escape that miserable school and the awful high schools in the Bronx. And there were a lot of kids who have had extraordinary victories. And one of them is this little girl, Pineapple, whom I met in kindergarten that year, the first week I was ever in the South Bronx. Her school, among its other problems, I mean, it was badly underfunded, as are all those inner-city schools to this day. It was also an ugly place. It smelled. The cafeteria was down in the basement, and it was like something from the Middle Ages. It was like a feeding trough for cattle. She had 34 kids in her class, 34 children, most of her years, and 36 got larger. By the way, it's still like that in New York. It's back to 36, 38 kids in a class, so that's not as bad as Los Angeles, where several teachers I know have more than 40 kids in a class. Anyway, her teachers kept quitting because the classes were so huge. So the principal, in order to try to make up for the huge class size, put into effect this really rigid uniformity of instruction, a kind of a drill-and-kill curriculum where everything was geared to the tests. We see this all over the nation now because of No Child Left Behind. Test results were everything. It didn't work. Kids didn't get to read any wonderful books that would actually excite them to want to learn to read. None of those beautiful children's classics like The Very Hungry Caterpillar, books like that, which they read in the suburbs. Nothing like that. They just had these horrible, boring sort of teach-to-the-test material. It didn't work. Pineapple learned nothing at that school. In fifth grade, I sat down with her, and she couldn't write a sentence longer than five words or read one. Then she was really smart, spunky, that she'd been artificially retarded by the institutional racism of America, by the vicious way we treat minority children. She was lucky. We got her, I say we, because I had friends who helped me with this, we got her into a terrific prep school. And by that, I don't mean one of these slogan-loaded, profit-making charter schools, but a prep school for rich children. And suddenly, instead of 36 in her class, she had 15. And her teachers at the prep school didn't have to test the kids to death. The children could learn from excitement instead of fear of examinations. And people always say, did it work? You bet it did. She not only suddenly made up 4 years of lost education at prep school, but graduated successfully. She'll be beginning her senior year of college just 1 week from now. She's what I mean by the fire in the ashes. Pineapple's experience shows us what we could do in the public schools if we spent the kind of money on impoverished children that we spend on the kids who live in places like Beverly Hills and Brentwood, or the children who go to exclusive private schools like the daughters of President Obama.
You met a lot of these kids in a particular homeless type of shelter.
Originally, I had met some of these kids when they were homeless in the late 1980s in Manhattan. But I include that in the book just to explain how I got to know the Bronx. Once the city shut down the homeless shelters, as they did finally, they moved all these black and Latino people en masse, and against their will usually, into this dismal neighborhood in the South Bronx. In other words, you know, they wouldn't dream of helping them move into a neighborhood in a middle-class, working-class neighborhood in Manhattan. No, they put them in the South Bronx where they'd be out of sight, where no one could see them. And then once they were there, of course, they got a classic taste of segregated and viciously unequal education. And it was like back to Plessy versus Ferguson. Forget about Brown versus Board of Education. It was like back to the 1890s. I have to say, Republican administrations have always been viciously opposed to at least giving these kids equal education, because that means higher taxes on rich people. Instead of money, they've given us this testing nightmare, No Child Left Behind. But the truth is, President Obama hasn't done much better. But President Obama really has disappointed me. He never speaks about the savage inequalities between rich neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods. He never speaks about the fact that wonderful, dedicated teachers in Los Angeles are coping with 40 kids in a class. I happened to speak just a few days ago at a school in Washington called Sidwell Friends, which is a very expensive private school where the president's children go. And they have like 15 in a class. And Bill Pineapple once said, if really small classes are good enough for the children of the president, sons and daughters of hedge fund billionaires, why isn't the same thing considered good enough for the poorest children of the poorest mothers in America? And I thought that was a good question. Panopel, by the way, hasn't lost her sense of loyalty to the place she came from. You know, some kids, when they make it finally, as she's done, and they get to college, and naturally, like many Americans, they'll say, now I can make some real money. They'll major in business or something, and they'll go to Wall Street. They might start at $100,000 a year. She's told me she's going to take an extra year and get certified to be a public school teacher, and she wants to go back to the Bronx to teach kids. And she said to me, Dr. King said this once, pass the torch along. And she said, that's what I've decided I need to do in life. Pass it on. Do it for the little ones I left behind. So her victory isn't just a materialistic victory. It's also a moral victory. And there are five other kids in the book like her, all of whom, having won spectacular victories, are now going back to share it with people they left behind in the neighborhood. But just one final thing I was going to say is, I admire President Obama, but he never speaks about these vicious inequalities. And in one way, he's made things worse. This testing nightmare, this thing of obsessively testing and retesting poor kids and drilling them all year to take these tests. I'm not talking about useful tests, like what we call diagnostic tests, where the teacher administers the test and corrects it herself and says, okay, I see Shaniqua needs more help with long division, and then she can actually do it the next day. I'm talking about bubble tests that the kids take, and they don't help the teacher at all because the results don't come back for 6 or 8 months. By the time the results come back, the child's not in her class anymore. The real purpose of these tests, in my opinion, is not to improve the education of poor children. It really represents an attempt to humiliate the teachers of poor children. On a larger scale, it represents a right-wing attack upon the whole idea of public education as a sacred American legacy. The same people who push obsessively for testing and more testing, these are the people who also have always opposed any kind of open housing so that Black and Latino folks would have a chance to live in the same neighborhoods as their kids and go to the same schools. And these people are always saying to me, because I still know some wealthy people in New York, or a few of them still speak to me, you know, and they'll say, Jonathan, can you really buy your way to better education for those children? You know, those children in quotes. And these are people who send their kids to private schools that cost $50,000 a year. And I'll just look them in the eyes and I say, I don't know. It seems to do the trick for your kids, doesn't it? And I just don't think we should let them get away with that hypocrisy. Instead of being willing to pay a much higher rate of taxation at the top levels of income, the wealthiest 1% or half of 1%, neither party is really pushing for that. Instead of proposing something like that, what they're doing is scapegoating the teachers in these schools and just humiliating them. They're printing the names of the teachers in newspapers, believe it or not, and they rate them according to their students' test scores. A teacher who's working her heart out but has 42 kids in her class that year, and a quarter of them are recent immigrants who don't yet speak English. It doesn't matter if it's that teacher or a lucky teacher who has only 20 kids. They both get judged by the same standards, and the teacher with the largest class opens the newspaper the next morning, and there's her name, and next to her name it says, worst teacher in L.A., or something like that. There's something brutal about this, and it's driving away the best teachers from our inner-city schools, and the president doesn't speak about this at all, and I regret that very, very much.
When you look at all of the kids that you tracked after knowing them 25 years ago, some you stayed in touch with, some you had to track down, I understand.
There were some who were difficult to find. I mean, I kept in touch with most of them through the years. Some of them had kept in touch with me all along and come up and visit me. The kids I wrote about are now in the early 20s. So
let's talk about some of them. In addition to pineapple, some were very sad stories and some were very inspiring stories, like the pineapple story. There were two in the very beginning that were very difficult to get through, Pietro and Vicky. If you could tell us a little bit about their experience and then maybe give us an analysis about what distinguished the ones who were able to succeed, like these moral successes, such as the one you described, and an analysis of the institutions for these very poor children.
Let me just focus on one child, Pietro's son, Christopher. I knew him when he was 8 years old, 9 years old. I met them in a homeless shelter. Once the city forced them all to move to the Bronx, they'd invite me up to come and have dinner with them at their home. They lived with their grandma also, and she really held the family together. And I'd go there for Thanksgiving and things like that. There were three children in the family. There was Christopher, who had been 8 or 9 when I met him. And then there were two little girls who were only 3 or 4 at the time. And the thing is, the little girls somehow, I don't know quite how to explain it, but some people would think, well, the littler they are, the more they must suffer. But it's not exactly true. They were so young that they didn't understand that they were being treated like dirt by the city of New York. They didn't get the picture. They didn't realize also that most people don't have to live that way. But the older child, the boy, who is pre-adolescent and then adolescent, teenager, he got the point of it. And he saw the humiliation of parents. He went on the train on his own, so he saw how the rich lived. He saw the expensive stores on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. And in every decade, we seem to have an economic crisis, but for some reason, those expensive stores like Saks Fifth Avenue are always full of people. They are full of customers. So, you know, even at this moment, there's plenty of super rich people in New York. And he saw this, and it embittered him. And it embittered him to a point that distorted his entire personality. And in order to survive, he had to learn to be a tough kid. See, the little girls didn't have to be tough because, as one of them, Miranda, said to me, I know her now very well. She's now a good friend. She said, he's the one who went out in the street and panhandled for us. She said, I didn't know it at the time, but he's the one who was dealing drugs to bring home money for us. So the girls remained kind of clean of spirit, whereas he became a really tough guy. And I always worried, and he spent several years in prison for a vicious crime where he and some other boys threw somebody under a subway train. The person nearly died, fortunately did not die. And he became kind of evil. But I was reminded that nothing he did was ever really quite as bad as what the city had done to him in the first place. That's the point. I was reminded of a line by one of my favorite poets, a British poet, W.H. Auden, who said, he said, when will we ever know what all school children learn? Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. That's not always true, but in his case, it certainly was. And I used to worry, will he kill somebody someday? Well, he didn't. Instead, he killed himself. He finally took his own life. Now, you might ask, why did he collapse when other kids like Pineapple and, oh, there's so many others in the book, like Jeremy and the others who went on to college, why did they succeed? Well, I'll be honest with you. To some degree, it's a matter simply of the child's strength of character. But to a large degree, it's because the ones who were successful also happened to have fascinating personalities. As little kids, they caught the eye of benevolent grown-ups, people who could help them. And Pineapple was just delectably funny. She used to push me around, boss me around all the time, tried to fix me up with her third grade teacher and so forth. But, you know, a little girl like that catches your attention. And the same was true about five other kids. So once they caught the attention of grown-ups, they benefited from philanthropy, from charity. They got scholarships to terrific schools, boarding schools, prep schools. They got the kind of education rich people get. The thing is, charity is a lovely thing, and frankly, I'd never turn it down, but charity is not a substitute for systematic justice. It's too selective. if there's any lesson in this book, it's not that we should celebrate exceptionality of opportunity. It's that we should give the very same thing they got to every kid in America within the public schools. They shouldn't have to charm you to death to get that.
That was going to lead into my next question, which is if the other kids would have gotten that kind of attention from an adult, from a charity, from a scholarship, would their lives have turned out absolutely better? Was that the key, in your opinion?
I described three boys who died at an early age. I think in one of these cases, the boy probably was on such a self-destructive bent by the time he was 10 or 11 or 12. I'm not sure anything would have turned him back. But in the other cases, the answer to your question is yes. If we intervene early enough and those boys got the kind of help that the troubled rich kids get when they not only go to terrific schools where the teachers can give them a lot of individual attention, but where they also get good health care and social workers or school psychologists who have plenty of time to talk to them and listen to them. Because those kids are smart, I think almost all of them would have succeeded. Maybe they would not all have gone to four-year colleges and graduated, but they certainly would have gone through community colleges, and they certainly would be leading reasonably decent lives today. A lot of people say to me, oh, Jonathan, you forget all the other forces of poverty that work against these kids. Can the schools really make a difference? And my answer is yes, they can. If they're terrific schools. There are a lot of liberals who are kind of, I call them impotent liberals, powerless liberals, futile liberals, who they'll point to so many different aspects of poverty, and they say, well, if you change this, that's good, but what about all these seven other factors? They leave you with this sense that nothing's going to work. So they don't say this, but the really hidden message is, why try? And my answer is, no, I'm not going to give in. I'm not going to give in that way. You know, that's too easy. That's the luxury of intellectuals who don't know the children. My answer is, if you give these kids spectacular, extravagant, richly funded education, and not in ugly, smelly buildings, but in beautiful buildings, if you give them buildings that give them the message, we value you a lot, that's why we're putting you in this beautiful school, and then you give them teachers who are relaxed and comfortable and can sit and talk with them at length because the class is so small and can refer them for counseling when they need help and so forth. I happen to believe that superb education can be the lever of change in our society. And in any case, it's the only one over which we have immediate power because the other factors are so complex and cloudy. You know, how do you get spectacular health care to every little kid in every corner of America? I don't know how. I don't know what you do about rundown slum housing stock all over America. It would take years to rebuild all those buildings or to knock them down and put up decent ones. But I do know this, that if we got the kind of resources in our inner-city public schools that they already have in wealthy towns like Brentwood and Beverly Hills, if we got that money today, 5 years from now, we would see a whole generation of young people who suddenly have a real chance at growing up into a happy and ethical and contributive maturity as empowered and effective American grown-ups.
Well, Jonathan Kozol, thank you so much. Again, the book is called Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America.
Thank you.
Stay tuned.
Dear Mr. President, were you a lonely boy? How can you say no child is left behind? We're not dumb and we're not blind. They're all sitting in your cells while you pave the road to hell. What kind of father would take his own daughter's rights away? And what kind of father might hate his own daughter if she were gay?
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. The week after Governor Mitt Romney blamed President Obama for the 46 million Americans living in poverty, President Bill Clinton took the stage to detail policy decisions that are contributing to the rising poverty rate. What are the factors driving more Americans into poverty, and what should be done about it? We have with us three experts. Peter Edelman is professor of law at Georgetown University Center for Law. He was assistant secretary for Bill Clinton's Department of Health and Human Services and resigned in protest of Clinton's 1996 welfare reform. Professor Edelman is the author of numerous books, including So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America, and co-author of Reducing Poverty and Economic Distress After ARRA. Randy Abelda is professor of economics and senior research fellow at the Center for Social Policy at University of Massachusetts Boston. She is the author of numerous books, including Unlevel Playing Fields, Understanding Wage Inequality and Discrimination, and Glass Ceilings and Bottomless Pits, Women's Work, Women's Poverty. Professor Frances Fox Piven is American professor of political science and sociology at the City University of New York. She is author of numerous books, including Regulating the Poor, Why Americans Still Don't Vote, and Who's Afraid of Frances Fox Piven, the essential writings of the professor Glenn Beck Loves to Hate. So welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. Professor Edelman, I think I want to start with you. Your recent piece in the New York Times detailed a pretty stark picture with regards to poverty in the U.S. What are we facing?
We're facing a large increase in poverty because of the recession, which is certainly not over in terms of real people around our country. On top of an increase that occurred through the Bush years in a more gradual way, so that 6 million people were added before the recession and 9 million more now. And so we had 46 million people who were poor in 2010. We're about to get the new numbers in a couple of weeks. We all think they'll be somewhat higher. And, of course, the poverty line itself is unrealistically low. Try to live on $19,000 for a family of three, et cetera. And just two other things I would add in terms of why we're in a very serious place right now, even after we have done a lot. We have public policy that works. We have 40 million people who would be in poverty on top of the 46 million if it weren't for Social Security and food stamps and the earned income tax credit and so on, almost twice the number. But two things that we need to understand that are extremely important beyond the really startling number of people who are poor, and that is the near poor, the people who are working at low-wage jobs, including some who are in poverty in low-wage jobs, and just can't really pay all the bills. We've got 103 million people, a third of our people, who have incomes below twice the poverty line. If you multiply that 19,000 number by two, you get the magnitude of that. So we have this flood of low-wage jobs that we should talk about. And then finally, in terms of the current situation, I would put on the table the striking and disturbing increase in the number of people who live in extreme poverty, deep poverty, below half the poverty line. That's 20 million now, and it's up almost 8 million since the new century started. In other words, there's been a huge increase there. So that's below $9,500 for a family of three. And in fact, we have 6 million people whose only income comes from food stamps because we've blasted a hole in the safety net at the bottom in welfare, TANF, temporary assistance for needy families, which is now become a part of presidential politics from the attack from the Romney side, is basically non-existent in over half the country. There are only a little over 4 million people who are receiving that, and that's why there's 6 million people whose only income is food stamps.
It sounds like you're saying that there are perhaps three different levels of poverty. You've got the near poor, the people who fall below the poverty line. I'm thinking there are some that are short-term poverty and some that are chronically poor.
There aren't numbers so clearly, but it's certainly true that most people who are ever in poverty are there for short spells, and relatively short spells. And those who are in deep poverty, most of them get out fairly quickly, although it just means that they're probably still poor. But you're absolutely right to add to the conversation the significant number of persistently poor, intergenerationally poor, that's a smaller portion, but it's the hardest group to work with. That tends to be associated with where they live. Inner cities, Appalachia, Indian reservations, Mississippi Delta, colonias in South Texas, but especially inner cities in terms of the numbers. And that's the hardest poverty to deal with.
Francis Fox Piven, I have to comment on this because I think that we're talking about poverty in the United States as though it's a horticultural phenomenon, as though it's something outside of the heaving and hauling of the politics of the country. I don't think we learn much about poverty by classifying the poor, about whether they're near poor or deep poor or where they live or any number of factors that may distinguish them, to be sure. I think we have to turn our attention to the extraordinary political and economic dynamics which produced a situation where about a third of Americans are what would be called poor in most of Europe today. This is bizarre. It's happened in what is still the richest country in the world, and we should be trying to find out who did it and how. And we should be talking about the answers to those questions. And if we pay attention to those questions, I think we'll immediately be turned to the way in which workplace policies, business policies changed so that workers lost ground in wages, unions were pummeled, and also the way in which organized business and the mobilized right, populist right, went after the social programs. The minimum wage has not been increased to keep up with inflation. Welfare has been slashed. The programs that we once put faith in as a kind of security net, a safety net, have been shredded in the United States. And that didn't happen as a kind of naturalistic phenomena that you could come to understand by describing the characteristics of the poor and how they can be classified. That happened as a result of a political dynamic in which some people plundered the programs on which other people depended, a lot of other people depended, and political attack in the workplace, which drove down wages. You can see right now that one consequence of the recession and the high unemployment it has created is that employers are taking advantage of the fear that workers have of not having a job, not being able to find a job, to drive down wages further, so that the new jobs that are being created are much lower paying than the jobs that were lost as a result of the recession.
Francis Fox Piven, I wanted to also ask about some things in your past scholarship that relate to this. You've talked about, in your scholarship, things that keep people poor, part of it being sort of a culture or superstructure culture, part of it being that some of these programs themselves are programs to keep people from developing an uprising.
I certainly can. I think that the political talk, or I would say propaganda, about poverty, some of which you could hear at the Republican convention, but we've been hearing it for 30 or 40 years now, which ascribes poverty to the defects in character of the poor. They don't really want to work. They don't really want to get ahead. And they're also associated with all sorts of deviant behaviors and any group of people who were exposed to that kind of public talk would be demoralized. Now, it is also the case that historically, poor relief or welfare programs have also practiced policies and stigmatization rituals, which have demoralized the poor. But in the 1930s and in the 1960s, the poor did overcome that kind of stigmatization. They did band together. They did fight for what they came to think were their rights. And, you know, when that happens in American history and in the history of other countries, when that happens, we get better policies. Indeed, I think the only way we get really decent policies for poor people is when the poor themselves become indignant and hopeful.
Randy Abelda, we've left you out of the conversation so far. What would you add?
I would also add that in some ways, to combine a little bit what both you and Francis said about, the poor are not distributed equally, and there's certain characteristics or there's certain groups of people that are more likely to be poor than others, and that matters too. And it matters largely because policies and workplaces have been shaped around those characteristics. So, for example, single mothers are a group of people who are most likely to be poor in the United States, and you don't need a PhD in economics, and you don't really need much to understand why. I mean, women make less than men. Mothers make less than other women, and single mothers are juggling both trying to provide income for their families and take care of their families. So it's not rocket science, and it's not hard to solve. But both our employment structure and our policies are built in such a way as to preclude the ability of single moms to be able to hold low-wage jobs, to hold any job that they can keep and support their family, plus take care of their kids. Anti-poverty policies, on the other hand, assume that people have no earnings whatsoever. And so they're structured in a way to give out cash assistance in a demeaning and more demoralizing way, but don't end up actually supporting employment, despite the fact that over the last 15, 20 years, that's been the main theme around anti-poverty policies, is to get a job. So I agree with Francis in the sense that it's a political objective in a way, and policies around workplace and around anti-poverty policies matter a lot. But it's also true that certain workers have been iced out. Certain workers are assumed to perform certain duties, both at home and in jobs. And those aspects matter, too.
Peter Edelman.
I agree with both Francis and Randy. I was trying to lay out some numbers so we would understand the scope of the problem. The next point, if I am on a podium myself, is to talk about why all of this is. And so it is about politics, and it is about kind of the felt needs of the employers, of the self-interest in having wages be as low as possible. And it's very much also a question of race and gender. The question of low-wage work, as Randy said, in terms of single moms who are working, who with all the low-wage jobs, there's only one wage earner in a household, there's going to be huge poverty. So almost 50% of children who live in households that are headed by a single mom are poor, astonishingly high number. In our household, that's about children, because my wife runs the Children's Defense Fund, but it's a women's issue. It's about the moms and the children. Same thing at the bottom. Who are the disproportionate, very, very poor people? It's moms and children, and it's because we absolutely slashed apart the program of income assistance for mothers and children, welfare. And race pervades the whole thing. I mean, why is it that African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans are poor at three times the rate of whites? There's a continuing theme of race right up to the current campaign of Mitt Romney and this attack on President Obama that's completely made up about the work requirements. But going back to Ronald Reagan and the woman who came to the grocery store in her white Cadillac and with her food stamps, she bought the best cuts of meat. And, of course, everybody knew that he was talking about an African-American woman. And, you know, we get later on in that decade and Willie Horton. There's always huge racial aspect to the politics about poverty.
A seeming effort to dismantle the public education system in a way that they argue will better it, they being the privatizers. Doesn't that also serve to rob people of their ability to move out of poverty? Peter Edelman, would you address education?
Well, right now, we're seeing disinvestment in education around the country as the states are having terrible budget problems. They're laying off teachers, and the problems, obviously, of the lowest income children are the worst in terms of what happens. The federal government should have continued the help that was in the Recovery Act in the first 2 years of President Obama's term. And, of course, the Republicans' determination to block absolutely everything and to say no to everything is why we didn't get that help to the states so they wouldn't have to cut the teachers. So that's what's going on right now. The larger question of the way in which we should be improving education, I mean, we absolutely, insofar as we are not preparing a population that has an increasing number of children of color, African-American, Latino especially, these are the people who are our workforce for this century. And in order to perform the jobs that we have, the better jobs that we have particularly, you have to have some post-secondary education. You certainly have to get out of high school. And so it's so short-sighted when we don't make the investments that we need to in our children, beginning with early childhood, which is absolutely fundamental. So we're certainly underfunding. We're not investing properly. And then we do get into these arguments that you raised about people who are attacking the public schools and want to privatize. I think that's important as well. But the fundamental, the larger question is making sure that we really do invest enough in children.
Francis Fox Piven, let's bring you back in. You brought up the political system. I hear you coming in on the education mark, but I also would love for you to talk more about the electoral arrangements.
I'll try to say a little about education. I'm in favor of investment in public education. I think all our children should have access to the best education possible. However, I don't think that the idea that education will solve the problem of poverty or inequality holds up, because we are a more educated people than we were 30 or 40 years ago. Many more of people in the workforce have a college education, and wages are falling. So we have to address the question of wage inequities, social program inequities, apart from education, even while we invest in education. But I have to talk about the electoral situation, because it seems to me it's so unbelievable, and yet it is believable if you know anything about American history. We tend to think of ourselves as the best, the first democracy. And yet there have been periods in American history when political parties deliberately set about pushing contentious groups out of the electorate. This happened after Reconstruction. Blacks were stripped, the freed slaves were stripped of the right to vote, which had been won for them in the Civil War and by them in the Civil War. It happened again in the early part of the 20th century, when waves of immigrants came to the American cities in particular, so-called reformers, Republican Party reformers, as it happens, set about trying to reduce their numbers in the electorate by introducing literacy laws, poll taxes, and elaborate voter registration procedures. And you know, right now, as African Americans and Latinos are becoming a larger and larger portion of the American electorate, 16 states have exerted themselves. They can't seem to pass any laws that we need, but they found the will and the way to pass laws which make it much harder for those people who are becoming a majority in American electoral politics, for those people to vote. Partly it's photo ID requirements, partly it's, as it is in Florida, for example, it's making it so torturously difficult for volunteer groups to register voters. But the Republicans even admit it. They make statements to the effect that we're going to make sure that Mitt Romney wins this election because we passed a photo ID law. Did any of us ever think that this could happen? Almost half a century after the Voting Rights Act was passed? I don't think so.
Well, we certainly saw Florida in 2000 and Ohio in 2004. But that brings us to a very important place, which is in the rearview mirror, the Republican Convention and the Democratic Convention. Perhaps we should take a look at what these platforms are offering. Randy Belda, what have you thought about what you've heard from these two parties?
Neither of these parties have really addressed the issue of poverty in the United States. Both seem to be saying they're aiming towards the middle class, and Republican policies are literally back to the neoliberal policies we've seen for the last 30 years around deregulation, devolution, tax cuts for the rich, more free and unfair trade. And we've seen what those policies have done. They haven't addressed poverty. In fact, what they've done is they've promoted employment at low wages without reforming the low-wage labor market. Democrats, on the other hand, I think, and initially the stimulus package was, I think, a blueprint to begin to address some larger issues, including those facing low-income families, especially those that needed employment or had low-wage employment, including modernizing unemployment insurance, moving towards giving states money to invest in human infrastructure and education and healthcare that states were cutting. I think there was a beginnings, a glimmering of trying to address some of these larger issues. Even some of the executive orders that Obama has done around the Fair Labor Standards Act and allowing CNAs to be part of that act so that they can make minimum wage, I think are in the right direction. But unfortunately, all those policies that Obama and his administration have actually been pursuing, extension of Medicaid, they don't want to talk about. They're almost embarrassed to make a claim that they're trying to reduce poverty and improve low-wage jobs. So I would hope that the Democrats would start talking a bit more about the structural issues around the loss of earnings for men, you know, the loss of manufacturing and the growth of low-wage services, employment promotion for low-income women, but without an employment floor. So, and what the Obama administration has done, I think, quietly and silently, is actually a better set of policies than what they're actually talking about. And lifting the floor, as, you know, as organized labor always argue, lifting the floor, the bottom, actually lifts everyone. So there's more promise among the Democrats, but we've yet to see it. And I have to say that Obama's, his Labor Department is working at odds with his Treasury Department. And as long as Obama continues to appoint people like Geithner and Summers and others who really essentially are protecting financial capital, I don't really see much in the way of moving and making these changes to begin to restructure both anti-poverty programs, to modernize them, as well as to address the floor, which is pretty low, of jobs in the United States.
Peter Edelman, what would you add to that? And also, where do you see us going from here?
I would add a lot, because that formulation, I'm sorry, doesn't get to the point. The point is that everything that we have that's in place to help low-income people, to help vulnerable people in our society, is under a dire threat of deep, deep cuts, and in many cases, the destruction of programs, turning Medicaid into a block grant, for example, so that the states could serve whoever they wanted and exclude whoever they wanted, turning Medicare into a voucher program, cutting food stamps, turning food stamps into a block grant. The list goes on and on and on. This is a stark choice. And to be talking about whether Obama took credit or whether people aren't talking enough about poverty, that's not the point. The point is that there is a threat to really the whole commitment we've had, flawed as it may be, to help those who are most vulnerable in this society. And President Clinton laid it all out, was very, very clear about it. So I just want to be anybody who's within the sound of my voice who has some doubt that President Obama didn't do enough or say enough about what he had done. And listen, President Obama did get Congress before the Republicans took over to enact the health care bill, which is historic in its significance and is bringing Medicaid to 16, 17 million people around this country, a huge hole in Medicaid that we had. There were tens of billions of dollars that helped low-income people, poor people in the Recovery Act. There's been a tremendous commitment in terms of the educational policy to try to make a difference for low-income children. We should be very clear that there is a stark difference between these two candidates for president, and one of them represents an enormous threat to everything that we have achieved for low-income people over many decades.
This is Frances Piven. Of course, I agree with Peter. Of course, and I think Randy does too. Of course, there's a tremendous difference between total Republican domination of the House, the Senate, eventually the court and the presidency, and Barack Obama and the Democratic Party. It's a very important election, and we should work for the election of the Democrats. That said, though, Barack Obama would be a better president, and the Democrats would be a bolder party if they were pressed by a social movement of the poor and working people who have been shafted by the policies of the last 30 or 40 years. So, yes, the election is important, but also, yes, we could have a better president and a better Democratic Party.
Frances Fox Piven, that brings me to something else that you've written about, which is why poor people don't organize.
The emergence of the kind of indignation and hope that fuels social movements can occur very, very quickly. I am optimistic that if the protests that were started by Occupy, if they persist and recur over the course of the next year or two, that poor people also will find the courage. You know, they can't be out on a limb just by themselves. They're too vulnerable. Will find the courage and the sort of inner resources to overcome the horrifying experience of insult and stigma that they have been exposed to by American leaders, and especially Republican leaders. So, yes, let's make sure that Barack wins the election, that the Democrats win the election. Then let's build a movement fire at his heels.
Oh, I think Frances said it very well, and she knows and that I agree completely that we're not going to get to where we have to unless we have people who mobilize, organize, whether that there's a real movement. And the only way we're going to get political leadership that gets us to where we need to go is if there's that sort of push from the bottom to make it happen. And there are people who would do much better if they were pushed to do it, and in many cases don't try even to do the right thing because there isn't that push. So I just would underscore and completely agree with what was just said.
Randy Abelda?
Clearly there's the stark choice, and dismantling every program that was built from the 1930s through the 1970s would obviously be, you know, a horrible scenario. So my point was is that I actually think the Obama administration has done a lot of things that have been useful and help for low-income people. My point being is that unless we know them, we won't know them. And also, I think that Frances is right. There has to be a movement, some organization that has to begin to address the quality of jobs in the United States. If we have an employment strategy for alleviating poverty, then employment has to alleviate poverty.
There seems to have been a movement that Gar Alperovitz has been documenting quite a bit in his America Beyond Capitalism among people to build things from the ground up that are cooperatives and worker-owned kinds of companies and these new types of community trusts as an alternative to just getting a job. What would be your response to something like this instead of trying to build it in the old paradigm? Frances Fox Piven, I'd like to start with you on this.
I'm very supportive of those experiments in alternative and more communal ways of building an economy, of producing the things we need and exchanging those things and exchanging them for money. Those experiments should be encouraged and applauded, and there have been few successes in the world, Mondragon being, I suppose, the most famous. But the unemployed of today, low-wage workers who are trying to support families on $20,000 to $30,000 a year, people who don't have any work, poor people, they have to be helped right now, as soon as we can. We should fight for the programs that will give them sustenance, give them work, give them opportunities. And yes, at the same time, I think we should encourage the experiments in an alternative economy.
Peter Edelman?
I agree. I think that Randy laid this out very, very well. I always say we've become a low-wage country, and there's a long list of reasons, but it's been going on for essentially 40 years. The kinds of things that Gar Alperovitz has written about, fine, as Frances said, But the heart of the problem here is low-wage work. And we haven't even identified the problem in any kind of wide way in which the politics takes any note of it. I mean, people know that they're struggling, obviously. But how do we change that? There's a list of things, and none of them is really going to get us all the way there. We have to do a lot of things because we have to pay attention to low-wage work, as well as having a decent safety net, minimum wage, the revitalization of unions, a whole series of supports that there needs to be in a decent society in terms of health care, child care, housing, and help with post-secondary education. And we're going to have a discussion in this country that we have not been having about wage support. If the labor market isn't going to produce enough income for people who are working as hard as they can, we need to have wage subsidies. We have the earned income tax credit. We have the child tax credit. We're not going to need to do more than that, and that's not even on the table.
Particularly for women, and particularly for single mothers and parents generally, it takes time to care for kids. And cooperatives and also just low-wage employment takes away from that time. And the problem, of course, with low-wage employment is that time is inflexible often, and parents have very little control over their time. So I think we need to start making the bigger links. So we were talking about education earlier. Well, low-wage jobs work against parents' time with kids, especially older kids, and their success in school. So I think that beginning to start and look at the quality of work, the income of work, and some of these outcomes and their direct relationship will get us further. But ultimately, I agree, we're going to need an increase in minimum wage. There's going to have to be a stronger union movement. But we're also going to have to think about more about universal child care, more money spent on adolescents. So I think we can't forget the time it takes and the inability of low-income parents to substitute buying things for their time that a lot of middle- and high-income families can do, and what impact that's having on communities and for all of us.
All right. Thank you so much to the three of you, Peter Edelman, professor of law at Georgetown University Center of Law, Randy Abelda, professor of economics and research fellow at the Center for Social Policy at University of Massachusetts Boston, Professor Francis Fox Piven, professor of political science and sociology at City University of New York. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Ishmael Karim. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.
May your goal.